Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Splash. I'm David Chen, and with me are
Mr. Hardware
and Jeff Cannata.
Welcome to the show, everyone. So today we are going to do a little bit something different. We're trying out a new format. One of the things people have said they've always loved about the show is our What We've Been Watching segments and our After Darks today. And so that's what we're going to do today on the podcast. We are going to do what we've been watching and then a couple topics in the Slash Homecast After Dark, hopefully, if we have time. We are going to do our best, but I think we'll have time. We'll give it a shot. You can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. But before we get into any what we've been watching, I do want to say something that has been bothering me in the 2 weeks since we recorded episode 553 about the rhythm section. That was the episode of the podcast where I talked about the Netflix original series Cheer. And Jeff said he doesn't like reality TV. And I tried to say, well, it's not reality TV. And I did a really poor job of explaining why it wasn't reality TV. It turns out that the director of Cheer, Greg Whiteley, actually appeared on The Business, which is a show that I listen to on KCRW. And he explained in an extremely concise and clear way what is the difference between documentary and reality TV. And let me just say, this is something I totally should have known and said and did not say because sometimes...
For shame. For
stupid.
Shame.
Sometimes I'm stupid. And that's okay. The difference between documentary and reality TV is reality TV participants are paid. And so they do things that the producers tell them to do in order to generate the maximum amount of drama or to kind of participate in the storylines. That the producers
It is pretty easy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And in documentaries, they're not paid. It's a chronicle of what's actually happening. And in fact, like Greg Whiteley, the director, is pointing out that often in making the Netflix original series Cheer, that people would say, hey, please stop filming. We don't want you to film this. It's too personal. And he would not be able to film it. And that is what happens when you are a documentary and not reality TV, because reality TV, people don't get to say that. So anyway, Cheer and reality TV are very, very different for many reasons. And one of them is in reality TV, the participants are paid. So I felt like I really had to clear that up.
I want to be clear that I was talking about my impression of the show, having not seen it, the impression that I had gotten second and third hand. That's all I was saying.
I see. Well, why don't we dive into what I've been watching? Actually, Jeff, why don't you go first, since we're on the topic of Cheer?
Yeah.
So on that week's episode of the podcast, a couple weeks ago, you talked about Dracula. I talked about Cheer.
Yeah.
And we said, hey, we'll each endeavor to watch each other's recommendations, which
yeah,
we have done.
Yeah, you begged me to watch Cheer. Yeah.
I don't know if begging is the correct word, but...
Yeah, you were begging.
Okay. Well, you know, I have
you
zero...
You were on hands and knees. At that
I have
point.
Zero yeah, regrets yeah. about
I that. I don't know what to say about that.
Zero yeah. regrets. So, Jeff, did you, in fact, watch Cheer?
I did. Here's the thing, Dave. I'm not... in love with Jerry. I love him and I just want what's best for him.
Uh-huh.
Is the thing.
Yep.
Is that I feel a love for him.
Yep.
And
he's
I just
special little guy.
I want what's best for him in his life. I feel an intense love for him.
Yep. Yep.
And everything he represents that's good.
Yeah.
And I want him to be okay.
Yep.
And be happy. So yeah, Cheer's great, and I, you know, obviously I had a wrong a misconception about what kind of show it was, but that's on me. But everybody who recommended it to me before Dave is right, and then also there's Dave.
Did you? So how many episodes in are you? Just out of curiosity.
I've watched 3 of the 6.
I see. Okay. So
I would like to have watched more. I was trying to do that, but there was lots of other stuff to watch for this episode as well. But yeah, I mean, last night my wife went to bed and I stayed up and watched the third episode because I love those kids and their struggles.
Yeah.
I do think that it is, here's the thing about Cheer. It is a show about things that I really love, which are people who are passionate about something
yeah.
coming together and all being a tiny part of a larger thing. I am a person that loves the theater. That is my cheer. That's my personal thing where we all come together and we all come from disparate places and we all come to this stage and we are a tiny part of a moving thing that is larger than the sum of its parts. And we all have to do our thing in order for it all to work together and be good. And I love that process. I'm completely in love with that process. And that's what this thing is about. And I also happen to really love very specific underground, not underground, but
subculture, let's say.
Subcultures, things that are not known by a lot of people, but are really intense for the people that love them. I mean, I'm a person that grew up being a complete nerd back when nerd actually meant something. I've said this before, but I grew up before the internet. So I actually was shocked. It sounds crazy to say it, but I was shocked that there were people when I got to college that liked Star Wars as much as I did. Like, it just seemed crazy to me that there were other people out there that liked Star Wars as much as I did. So there's a intense love that I have for subcultures and really deep, passionate, very specific niche, you know? And it's having a window into this world where people know other cheerleaders and there's a history and there's, they study film of the, 1996 Daytona, all of that-ness of it, the nitty gritty of that world is also very interesting to watch and very fun. And then the characters are fascinating. And I talked about how I dislike reality TV because it creates characters out of people and it is often disingenuous. It is often manipulative and kind of gross to me. But I do love documentary and this is much more along those lines, but it does create characters out of these kids, out of their coaches.
I would argue, Jeff, that cheer creates people out of characters.
I don't even know how to parse that.
I say it glibly, but I also just mean it takes these people who you think, like, you watch them and you're like, oh, I think I understand who that person is. And then you realize, wow, like, they have a much richer and more interesting and sometimes more tragic history than you can possibly understand.
It is beautifully structured in that it does give you, I love how it often shows you, creates heroes and villains, and then shows you delves into the world that those heroes and villains came from, and you go, oh my gosh, I had them all pegged wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's really lovely. I mean, it shows, it's something you can extrapolate into your life and say, oh, everyone has a story and everyone is dealing with things that you can't possibly be privy to at any given time. And so you have these people that on a reality show would play up the conceited kid who thinks he's better than everybody else and is full of swagger and then gets his comeuppance when he misses the stunt that he was supposed to do. And in a reality show, that would be the sum total of your experience. And you would go, ah, yeah, I'm rooting against you because I'm rooting for this other kid whose spot you've taken. But in this show, this documentary series, there's more nuance, there's more information, and the show presents that scenario and then goes, hey, look at the backstory of both of these kids and realize what they're dealing with, where they come from. I mean, in a lot of ways, cheer is about America in a very sad way, and it is a kind of a crushing show. There's a sequence in, I think, even in the first episode maybe or the second episode where we literally see a teacher in this small Texas town giving people Texas history lesson and saying some truly horrifying things from my perspective, like Tex-Mex isn't actual Mexican food. It's better. She literally says that, but not in a as a joke and not ironically. It was, you know, it's like, I'm packing heat all the time. You know, I'm one lady who likes to, you know, and so the documentary has wonderful concentric circles of awareness of, you know, the interpersonal struggles of these kids and their coaches and the competition, the sport, in general, the sport of cheerleading in general. And then it keeps going out and saying, oh, here's the context of where this sits in America, where it sits in the lives of these people and the states that they come from. And, often the lives that are very difficult that these kids can come from and have this one small moment of glory. Commitment to a glory. Yeah. That's a really good way of putting it. It's really good. And you were right. But again,
I just need to record that and play. I'm recording it right now. I'm going to play.
I mean,
that
you were right after a lot of other people were already right. So, but I will say that I hope I was clear a couple weeks ago when we talked about it, that it was really all my impression of this thing from a distance. And it felt like, this is going to be like a reality TV show. And, I just was, and I even said, I think that I had a misapprehension about that. And I clearly did. And I'm glad I watched it. And now you're going to crush me by your opinion of the thing I liked.
Well, I'll just say that I finished Cheer. I will not spoil anything. Except I will just say my experience was that it is incredible. Like it is so good that it is now like become one of my formative documentary watching experiences. Like it has expanded what I think it is possible to do with the documentary format.
Go ahead.
Well, just like I'm thinking, you know, like there's heroes I have like, Errol Morris and Andrew Gibney, Alex Gibney. And, you know, there's many films by these people that I've watched and I'm like, oh, like, okay, you know, some of them they've made great films. They've made okay films. And, but they've been formative in like helping me understand like, how documentaries can work. And this is now going to be one of those things for me. Like that's how good it is. And I wish I could say more, but you know, I don't want to spoil anything for you. I'll just say that finishing this series was a beautiful, moving, powerful, poignant experience for me. I cannot recommend it highly enough. So, that's Cheer season one on Netflix.
I mean, I was crying. So yeah.
I've seen the first episode, and if all that hasn't convinced listeners, I will say it gave me a lot of Friday Night Light vibes too.
Yeah.
Like just seeing the lives of these, you know, these kids and what they're going through. I think Friday Night Lights is a fictional story based on a real, you know, a real, book about an actual town and team, but I think the heart of it is really there. So I can't wait to finish it.
All right. Why don't we get to our first sponsor this week, Lightstream. Jeff, you want to tell us about Lightstream?
I'm a person, fellas, that does not like to carry a credit card balance at all. It can be debilitating, credit card debt. Oftentimes, you'll have credit card interest rates over 20%. That's just impossible to get out from under. It's predatory, quite frankly. From my perspective, it's very difficult to get out from under that. And there are some options. Our sponsor, Lightstream, is one of those options. You can pay off your credit card balance with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream that could save you thousands in interest. You can get a fixed rate from as low as 5.95% APR with auto pay. And the best thing about Lightstream loans is that they have no fees. There's no application fees, no origination fees, no transaction fees, no prepayment penalties. Plus, you can get your money as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream believes that when you have good credit, you deserve a low rate and great service, and that's exactly what they deliver. So get out from under your credit card debt. You know, it's one of those things that is hard to have a life with that kind of credit card debt. Just for listeners of Slash Filmcast, you can apply now and get an additional interest rate discount from Lightstream. The only way to get that discount is to go to lightstream.com/ Filmcast. That's lightstream.com/filmcast for an additional discount. lightstream.com/filmcast. FILMCAST. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes a 0.50% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/filmcast for more information.
Jeff Cannata, what else have you been watching this week?
Well, lots of stuff. I mean, I know there's stuff that all three of us have watched. I don't know how much we want to get into all that yet. But I'll tell you about something that I watched that I'm so grateful has come into my life. And this is a gift to all the parents out there. This was actually a listener to my video game podcast sent in this suggestion to me because I talked about PJ Masks and some of the stuff my son was watching. And this listener from Australia suggested a show that is now on Disney Plus called Bluey. Have you guys heard of Bluey yet?
I have not heard of Bluey.
It is a children's program, but I will tell you, it is one of my favorite shows. Not one of my favorite shows that my son watches, not one of my favorite kid shows. I would watch Bluey without my son. I would watch it without my kids. It is magic. It's so, so wonderful, this show. It is an animated show, traditional cell animation, about anthropomorphized dogs. So it's a family of dogs, a mom and the dad, and Bluey and Bingo are the two kids. And it is just about their life. And it is a show that makes me want to be a better parent. It is just a show about parents parenting their kids. And I'm going to make a comparison that I guess I'm not supposed to make anymore. And I understand why. But I will say that The Cosby Show is still a great show, despite the monster that is the titular character. Bill Cosby, it turns out, is a horrible human being. But I loved his comedy growing up, his stand-up. And I loved The Cosby Show when I was a kid. And the thing I loved most about The Cosby Show was, I don't know how many people remember this, probably a lot of people listening do not remember that show at all, but the best episodes of The Cosby Show are when they set up elaborate games or imagination scenarios where they would transform their entire living room into a different place. And, Theo would walk in and, Dr. Huxtable would pretend to be the maitre d' at a restaurant, but it was their living room, and they just transformed the whole living room into this restaurant, and all the grandparents were playing a part, and everybody, and they were teaching Theo how to, you know, go out to a restaurant for the first time or something. And the way they did that is they had elaborate games of imagination. I loved those episodes, and that's what Bluey is. Bluey is animated, and it's about dogs, but every episode is this trip of great parenting. It's parents like coming up with wonderful games for their kids, talking to the kids in ways that just make me emotional and seem so beautiful. The very first episode is called Keepy Uppy, and the entire episode is about how they try to keep a balloon in the air for the entire episode. They're, you know, all the different things you do. I'm sure everybody listening has played that one time or another when you're a kid. You get a balloon and it starts sinking and you have to hit it up in the air, and then everybody's trying to keep the balloon in the air. The entire first episode of Bluey is about trying to keep a balloon in the air. And that's just what it's about. How fun it is. There's an episode called The Dump, which is my favorite episode that I've seen so far. It's just about the dad taking the two kids to the dump, and they're going to, you know, give away some old things. And the son realizes that they're going to throw away some of his drawings. And the dad is like, I'm really sorry. I didn't realize how much these meant to you. And then he tells him a story about how, like, well, he says, you can just throw it into the dirty old dump. He said, no, I'm not going to throw it in the dirty old dump. I'm going to throw it in this part of the dump, which is the recycling area. And so this piece of paper that you drew your drawing on is going to be turned into new pieces of paper. And some other kid is going to get to do their drawing on pieces of what your drawing was. And that's going to continue changing and evolving. It's just these like beautiful life lessons that are, that come from a, expressed in such genuine, wonderful ways. I cannot speak highly enough about the show. I would watch it just to watch it as a person without kids. It is that good. It's great.
All right. Well, the show is Bluey. And how did you watch it again, Jeff?
It's on Disney Plus.
Check it out. Yeah. There.
I'm looking forward to doing that. I have been watching Hilda on Netflix in the same way. It is a very, very good traditionally animated show, but also has a lot of fun little lessons in there.
That's great. Yeah, I also love the animation style of Bluey. It's such a vibrant, colorful. It also, it makes me want to like live in Australia, even though it's not really about Australia. Just like everyone's there. It's great. It is so, so, so good. And my son loves it. And my wife loves it. We like get so excited about sitting down and watching another episode of Bluey. And each half hour is made up of three different episodes. So you can, they're really quick and you can say, okay, we can watch one before bed. And it's just, you know, 7 or 8 minutes. It's great. It's great.
Jeff, you also had a chance to check out the Lock and Key series on Netflix, right?
I am a huge fan of the comic book series. And I remember, you know, back in the days of the Totally Rad show, we reviewed the comic book series. We actually also reviewed the first time this was turned into a pilot, television pilot.
Man.
They had a exclusive viewing of that at Comic-Con 1 year. Don't ask me to say what year it was. It's been a while. But we reviewed the pilot, the first pilot they ever made for this. Which never went to series. It was just a one-off pilot. And we all were all sad because we had such a love for Lock and Key. And now Lock and Key is a Netflix show, a full season Netflix show. And I watched the first episode and just really have no desire to watch more of it. I'm really sad.
Yeah. That is a feeling I got, by the way, from the trailer. Like, I've read the comics. I really enjoyed them. I followed this, like, first of all, there was that failed pilot. There was a movie attempt. There was the Hulu attempt, and I think it came back from the dead when Netflix took it and was kind of revived from whatever they were going to do at Hulu into this format of the show. And it looks and feels a lot like a typical Netflix teen show, but I can't tell. So I haven't watched it yet, but Jeff, thoughts?
I mean, like I said, I've only watched the one episode, but man, I struggled to make it through the whole thing. It just, it's really, I glacially paced. It just doesn't, it feels lifeless and limp. I mean, I know that it departs significantly from the comic series in subsequent episodes, because I was reading a bit about it on /film.com. The first episode, it hews pretty closely to the initial, you know, first couple of episodes, excuse me, first couple of issues of the comic. But somehow it just doesn't have the magic and mystery of the comic book.
The book starts out with like a pretty key, terrible event, right? And it doesn't sound like the show deals with, like, I hear it happens
No, the show starts out with a pretty key, terrible event, but, it shows it pretty graphically. Okay. And, it's impactful, but I don't know that. It's sad to me. I would highly recommend people read the comic book series. It's great. I mean, I bought them in hardcover. I loved them so much. I had them in single issues. I had them as a collected trade paperback. And then I bought them again as hardcovers because the hardcover editions were so beautiful. It's a great comic. And it's kind of a horror book, but it's also about magic. And in the way that Stephen King, the best of Stephen King is, and this, of course, written by his son, but you know, the story revolves around a house in which there are a number of keys that can do magical things. And each key has its own magical property that can do wild things. Like, you can unlock your own brain. You open your head like a lid and look inside it to see thoughts. You can, a key that'll take you anywhere, all these kind of wild ideas. It's a great comic, and I just, perhaps the series on Netflix gets better past the first episode, but boy, I was very disappointed. It just felt plodding and lugubrious. It just, it did not, there's no life to it. It really felt,
At least with things like Comixology out there, like it is very easy to catch up on these series. Like I always prefer the physical books, but for a quick, like, hey, read the first issue, you know, or check out, you know, the first chapter. It is that's a really good way to do it. It's a shame. And it's kind of how I feel about, like, who knows if Why the Last Man will actually ever happen. And if it happens like this, like, please don't. Like, just don't do it. I do kind of love that Brian K. Vaughan and his collaborators on Saga built that thing. Like, that comic is done in such a way that you just cannot adapt it. Like, you can maybe do it. You can maybe animate it, but you cannot really translate that series to the screen in a really traditional way.
I mean, everything I've heard about Brian K. Vaughan is that he is he's been through the Hollywood ringer, and I don't think much desire to play that.
He ran
game.
A TV show. He ran ran Under the Dome, and that was a disaster. Good.
Didn't he work on Lost for a while too?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm sorry to hear you didn't enjoy Lock and Key, Jeff. But you also had a chance to watch one episode of Mythic Quest on Apple TV Plus. Which is kind of a Silicon Valley-esque comedy about video games. And as somebody who hosts a video game podcast, curious what you thought of Mythic Quest.
Yeah, and from the team behind It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which I put among my very favorite half-hour comedies of the last, decade. So I was very excited about this, and doubly so because oftentimes on this very podcast, Devendra Hardwar is my lodestar. I can always trust Devendra's recommendations, and Devendra spoke very highly about Mythic Quest.
It seems like you left like at least one person out of that list of people who are your lodestar.
Let's see.
It sounded right to me. It sounded right.
Let me think. There's Devendra Hardwar.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
I think that is it. I think I got it. I think I did it.
Okay.
No one has ever recommended something that turned out to be good.
Yeah. Okay.
Other than Devendra.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Yeah. Anyway, this time I don't know what show he was watching because I really was excited to watch this, and the first episode, I think it may
have a bit of first episode itis, I'd say. But let me just say, I'm coming off of this. I started watching this show after watching right after the third or fourth episode of Avenue 5, which is just abjectly terrible. Like, it is just, I can barely stand that show. So this felt like a breath of fresh air. Jeff, if you watch a little more, like, you don't really have to go longer for it to get good. I think it's really enjoyable. I'll talk more about it, but you finish your thoughts.
Well, I've gotten many tweets from people saying episode 5 is like this gem of an episode. So I may stick around.
Episode 5 is a short film. Starring people I love, people you probably do love too. It is a perfect little indie short film set in the world of game development. And I do kind of wish the entire series was kind of more like episode 5, because what it's doing is really fun and inventive and bold and romantic. And the show itself doesn't always reach there. But I've finished the series. I really enjoyed the experience. I don't think it was like transformative. I don't think it like reached the heights of like Silicon Valley did. But it's also like, there's a lot of heart to it. I really like these characters, and it's really interesting to me to see like this show actually explores a lot of big issues facing, the gaming world. This is a series co-produced by Ubisoft. It was actually
an idea. Yeah, you can tell because there's Ubisoft game footage throughout, and it's funny that they...
I was worried because they basically pitched the idea to Rob McElhenney and crew. And I was like, oh man, is this just going to be like a big Ubisoft ad? And there are clips from, Assassin's Creed and stuff. But I think like this show does explore a lot of fun things. And this cast is really good. I think the strength of the cast really carries it along.
Are those actual game clips from Ubisoft game? It seemed like it was from
there. There are some.
No, they use For Honor and Assassin's Creed.
I see. I saw an Assassin's Creed-esque thing where he dives into a thing. I didn't know that was actually Assassin's Creed.
And they also create the graphics for like the Mythic Quest game too. It's all up.
So there's stuff that's created for the show, but there's a lot of other, and I think it's just like a mishmash of them saying, yeah, this game is like everything, but I will say, I also might, I work right now at a video game company. And I may be more attuned to how things actually work than the average viewer.
Yeah.
And I know that there is a lot of comedy to be had out of how all that stuff works because I see it day to day. And I just felt like this show, I don't know. I came away thinking, you know, when you watch The Office, you feel like, oh my God, those people have definitely worked in an office. Sure. They so get it. You know, oh yeah, yes, that is exactly the moment that I had with the guy in the next cubicle.
But if you judge The Office by the first episode, you probably wouldn't want to.
I agree. And I get that. And that's how we are with TV these days, where it's like, you can't just watch one, you know, and I know, but I had a hard time getting through one with both this and Lock and Key. And I was like, I'd rather just go watch more Cheer, you know? Anyway, it just didn't feel authentic to the experience of game design to me. And the comedy didn't feel as like, it's okay to divert from that if it's for comedic gain, but I didn't end up laughing in the first episode. And so it just didn't land for me. And maybe I got to give it to, you know, people say that episode 5, you don't even need to watch the previous episodes to get it. So maybe I'll just jump right to that.
You can't just do that. But also I feel like if you do that, then it'll be even harder for you to watch the rest of the series. Episode 5 is very, very good. I'm not going to say too much about it. Overall though, like I really enjoyed the series. I think it's a lot of fun. I reviewed it over at Engadget, and I think it's a good combination of the stuff they were doing with It's Always Sunny, except I can't watch that show. That show physically makes me like itch. Like I get hives watching it. Like
it's just a show about awful people.
It's about garbage people being garbage to each other and failing through life. And, you know, they support each other through that. So that's something. And honestly, after watching this, I want to give It Sunny another chance. This show is kind of interesting because it's about people who actually care about what they're doing and they're good at their jobs, like a lot of them are, and supporting each other along the way too. So this also kind of fits into your Cheer definition a bit, Jeff. And what's interesting too is that the game they're supporting is like, it's already popular, it's already a big MMO, so now they're just doing like, we got to keep this thing alive, so they're doing like a lot of like mission critical jobs. It's not like Silicon Valley where they're starting from the bottom and like slowly making their way to the top. Maybe like they're not fighting for success in the show, but I think because of that, it can explore some like really interesting, conversations, and it can do a lot of things with these characters. You know, there's a point where they bring up a cutscene from Red Dead Redemption 2 and characters are just crying at the screen. You know, it's F. Murray Abraham crying at Red Dead Redemption 2. And there's a lot of cool things like that that I feel like, oh man, I'm really glad this exists. This is a really fun thing to watch.
I just want to say quickly in defense of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia that they are awful people, but they are always the butt of the joke. Like it's not a show about how great awful people are. It's a show about how awful people are. And they are always the butt of the joke. And I think it takes some skill to do that and still make the show endearing. And I genuinely love that show. So
it sounds like Jeff has watched one episode. Devendra has watched the whole thing. I've seen about three episodes of Mythic Quest. And I'm on Devendra's side. I think it's great.
I'm glad to hear that.
I empathize with you, Jeff, that like if you are in the situation that the show is depicting, It can be difficult to really, because at no point did I actually feel like this is how an actual game studio is run. You know, my feeling is that it is a gross, having worked for Xbox, I wasn't part of the Xbox game development side, but I kind of was around it enough to know like this is not what it's like.
Sure, sure.
This is like probably a gross oversimplification. But once I accepted that, I did feel like this is very, very fun. And love the characters. F. Murray Abraham is doing some great work in this show, and he's probably my favorite part of it so far. So I enjoy Mythic Quest as well. Devendra, any other thoughts before we move on?
It's tough to compare it to Silicon Valley, and I feel like that is the natural thing here, but this to me feels more like Office Space and, you know, similar workplace shows. Like the workplace comedy is a very tried and true format, and I don't think this tries to reinvent it, but I'm hoping based on episode 5 and based on some of the things I see later in the season that maybe they can make some bigger swings in season two. I just think it's a lot of fun. The thing about Silicon Valley is that it was so sharp and so true. Like, that's the thing. Like, I'm in that world, and what that show was doing was so accurate, and they were so smart about it. So it is really hard to live up to a standard like that, for sure.
All right. Well, let's move on. But before we get to our next piece of what we've been watching, we got to thank our second sponsor this week, Pretty Litter. Devendra, can you tell us about Pretty Litter?
So winter in New York is terrible, and it's especially terrible if you're taking care of cats, because it usually means lugging 20-pound boxes of litter from the pet store, and that's not fun. I have two cats. So what I like is Pretty Litter, and I've been using that a lot recently. It is a new age, modern litter that's delivered right to your door. And I find that to be super convenient. You don't have to go anywhere. You just have to open your door. Maybe sometimes help out the mailman who's carrying these things. But it is super great and super convenient. They use super light crystals to trap odor and release moisture. And it gives you like a dry, low maintenance litter. And it doesn't actually smell, which is a problem I've had with a lot of other litter options. It's dust free, especially useful if you're allergic to cat litter. And I like that it spares my sanity. It's shipped in a small, lightweight bag. It lasts an entire month, and I don't have to deal with running to the store. And the last time I had to run to the store, it was raining. It was very cold. I was carrying groceries at the same time, and you're doing all that with like a 20-pound box. It's not fun. Not a fan of it. But above all, I really like that Pretty Litter also gives you a sense of your cat's health. It helps you just by looking at the changing colors when your cat pees. It can tell you if there are underlying issues like any kidney issues or anything like that. Like, that basically the sort of things that you can't really see from normal litter. It's kind of doing double duty here, so I really appreciate that. So you can't change the weather, but you can change your kitty litter. Make the switch like I did today. Go to prettylitter.com and use promo code FILMCAST for 20% off your first order. That's prettylitter.com, promo code FILMCAST.
All right, let's move on. Let's talk about a few things I've been watching this week. I had a chance to see BoJack Horseman. Finished the entire series of BoJack Horseman. They debuted the second set of episodes of season 6, I want to say, at the end of January, and I kind of binged the whole thing in 2 days. And I think the show is still brilliant. It's still amazing. And that this ending was one that was worthy of a show. You know, it wasn't like an immensely satisfying mm-hmm. ending that brought everything to a close. But I can't explain why it didn't do that without saying anything spoilery. But I will say that I thought it was an ending that honored what the show was trying to do. Are you guys still watching? Are you planning to finish the show?
I have not finished. I was trying to finish before we talked about it, but no, I'm still on the first half of season 6. So, but I just adore the show. I sip BoJack like a fine wine. I don't binge, and I adore this show so much.
I will say that the one thing I will reveal, not about the second half of season 6, but just about season 6 in general, is that I really appreciated that the show is grappling with shows about problematic men, you know, uh-huh. and that in the TV industry, we've seen tons of hit shows about problematic men. I'm thinking of Vic Mackey from The Shield, you know, McNulty from The Wire. Walter White from Breaking Bad, one of the most iconic ones, Tony Soprano. And these shows theoretically condemn these men's behavior, right? Like, I think the show, if you look at the totality of what these shows are saying and doing, it is anti these men. At the same time, it also makes these men look super cool and kind of appealing in many ways. And I think BoJack is really grappling with that idea that for 5 seasons or 4 seasons, you know, it had BoJack Horseman, this character who was a raging asshole, but he inhabited this kind of fun world where you kind of still root for him, and he has all these poignant adventures with these crazy cast of characters. And I think it felt to me like the writers behind the show really started to worry that people would get the wrong impression about BoJack Horseman and feel like he's someone you should be like, you know, and they really wanted to say like, no, you shouldn't. And also, they wanted to explore, like, what it is, what is the net effect of these depictions on the world. And I really like that. I really enjoy when a show kind of grapples with its own legacy in the way that BoJack Horseman did and does, especially in its final episodes. So, big fan of the show. If you haven't gotten into it, give it a season and a half at least before you quit. It's worth it.
Can I talk about one episode that I found particularly amazing? It is in the first half of season six, but there's an episode that is pretty much exclusively about Princess Caroline's adoption of a baby.
Yeah, raising a kid, yeah.
It is, as someone who has kids, I immediately was like telling my wife, you have to watch this because my wife is very career-driven and very ambitious and very professional and is a... is an executive at her company and really values her career and puts a lot of energy into it, but also wants to be an amazing mom and is an amazing mom. And I don't think I've ever seen a show, certainly not a half hour comedy, certainly not an animated show, ever express how difficult and impossible that is better than that half hour with Princess Caroline, a cat who is raising a porcupine baby. And the beauty of it, it is really talking about how, you know, she's a career woman on the show and has a lot of ambition and wants to be great at her job and also wants to be a mom and is doing it as a single mom, which is, it just seems crazy to unfathomable to me how difficult that is as a two parent unit, knowing how hard it is. But you know, they use this conceit in the show, this interesting visual representation of what the internal life of a new parent is like. And they split her off. Anytime she's on screen in that episode, you see 5, 10, 20 different Princess Carolines all sort of silhouetted doing different things. And showing how crazy making it is to be a new parent where you have this sleep deprivation and you're trying to hold it all together and there's so many things happening all at once and you're pulled in so many directions and that you don't understand why the kid's crying and you have to try to maintain your life and also appease the child. And this like splintering of her consciousness into this constant cacophony of chaos and disorder and multiple responsibilities. I just found it to be so effective and so moving. And then there's the layer of her judging herself and other people judging her against how other women perform and her sort of getting roped into this women who do it all gala that she has to throw and trying to be a woman who, quote, does it all. I'm not a woman. I watch my wife and I see how amazing and how difficult it is for her to have to try to do it all. And in the context of this kind of show, because it's still funny. That episode's still funny, hilariously funny. To do that so effectively and to find a visual representation that expresses it so effectively, my hat's off to the show. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. It was amazing. I watched the episode with my wife as well, and she was blown away by it because it does such a great job of encapsulating the madness of having a child. And my wife hasn't gone back to work yet, but she is like, she wants to. And that is the worry. Like that episode is just like, oh God, how can I do if Princess Carolyn can barely do it? How can I? It's so hard. It's such a hard thing. Yeah.
It also reminded me of Tully, by the way. A movie that we all enjoy, but was an
underrated movie, man.
Underrated, like didn't perform very well at the box office, but was a great film in my opinion. So
I agree, man. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's one of those ones. You know, you have those movies that like stick with you, and you'll reference. You know, my wife and I reference Tully all the time because it's like a shorthand for a very specific kind of feeling. Yeah, great movie.
Also, because not many things have explored that specific side of like having kids. I do feel like a lot of people, you hear the good stuff but nobody tells you like the warnings of just like, oh, abject, you know, being tired all the time, like not having time to yourself and a lot of things like that. So Tully, shout out to Tully. I did finish BoJack and have to say, I really love this season as a whole, specifically because this is a season where I feel like more specifically people are calling BoJack out on his shit. And I feel like I would have loved to see more of that throughout the series. I love this show. I do feel like maybe towards season three, season four, it felt like there was a certain bit of repetition. It felt like in terms of how it was, you know, studying things like, oh man, he's bad, but he's depressed and he's sad and he's had a bad childhood. And like, we repeat that so often. It feels like it was starting to excuse his behavior.
I felt like season five probably was the worst in terms of just like repeating the same beats we'd seen before.
Yeah.
So I was a little worried that season six wouldn't bring it back and go to new places, but season six, I think definitely does go to new places. And so, I really love the show. Again, it's BoJack Horseman. It's on Netflix. You should watch it. Okay, Jeff, I watched Dracula.
All of it?
I watched, as of this moment, I have seen 2.5 episodes of Dracula.
Okay.
So I had to stop in the middle so we could record this podcast.
But you've seen through the end of episode two.
I've seen through the end of episode two. That's right. So here's how I would summarize my experience watching Dracula. My wife watched episode one with me, and I think her description of it is really apt. She said, this is a classic Netflix show in that it is good enough that I want to know what happens at the end, but not good enough that I actually want to watch it, is how she put it. I was not a huge fan of this show, unfortunately. I think that here's what's good about the show. I think the main...
Yeah, I didn't like Cheer either.
Okay. I think the main performer in Dracula is great. The guy who plays Dracula himself.
Clay's Bang. It's kind of like a melted Colin Farrell a little. But he's good.
It's excellent casting. Awesome. Excellent casting. I also appreciated like that the show is extremely ambitious, right? And without revealing too much about what happens, I'll just say each of the three episodes happens in a different setting.
Three different films.
Yeah, it's like three different films, but it features the same character and the same actor playing Dracula. And I liked how ambitious it was, and it tries to have some interesting takes on the classic character. But ultimately, I think the biggest problem for me is I just felt like two problems. Number one, the show is very repetitious, in my opinion. I think that just like the episode you were talking about, oh my gosh, three episodes, so short, breezes by. And I did not feel that way. I felt like this is like, okay, like the show hits certain points over and over again. Like, you know, the scene when the guy gets to the in the first episode where one of the characters arrives at Dracula's castle, and it's like, The scene when he gets to the castle just feels like it goes on forever. And I know like the show is trying to like set the scene and like here's the situation. It's a very scary castle, blah, blah, blah. But it's like we have seen that situation so many times before. And I felt like this show didn't add anything new to that. And there's many things like that where I'm like, okay, I get it. Like you don't need to repeat this over and over again. Like I understand. So that's one problem that I have with the show. The other problem is I felt like a lot of the characters surrounding Dracula are either unlikable, but more importantly, dumb. You know, like, Jeff, in the past, we've talked about movies like Green Book The Green Room is what I mean. Those are very different movies. Where you've been impressed, like, oh, these people are so smart. They're acting in ways that I wish I would act if I was in that situation. And these characters in Dracula do not act the way I would act, Jeff. They act quite in the opposite way. They act in often stupid ways that imperil themselves. And...
Well, but I think that the show is about Dracula and this other character.
Yeah.
And it is about the tete-a-tete between their intellects. And yes, everybody else behaves like dumb horror movie characters, but that is, I think, purposeful to accentuate that these other characters are working on a completely different level. And it's commenting on that horror. Those horror tropes and saying, I don't know. I thought that was a chess match that's happening on a different plane than the normal. Literally, it's like happening literally above the plane of a normal Dracula movie, which is also happening.
Yeah, literally, Chessmaster Jeff. But also, that makes sense. Actually, that makes sense the way you describe it. And I do want to say that Dolly Wells, the actress who is the she is very good in this movie.
So awesome.
Her and Clay Spang are like the best components. And if it was more of them, I would actually enjoy the show much more, I think.
I mean, it's a lot of them.
It's a lot of them. Yeah. It's
the,
like
the first episode is barely them.
It's like 30% them, Jeff. It's 30% them and 60-70% not them. And that's kind of, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Is a lot of it is also not them. So I unfortunately didn't enjoy it as much. But it's always cool to see a classic character redone in some way. And the show adds enough new things that I appreciated the contributions it's trying to make to Dracula lore.
Yeah, it's engaging the material. I just wish
it was a little shorter and it had more of the tête-à-tête, as you were saying. Like I wish three movie length episodes, in my opinion, was too long. I think it should have been 3 1-hour long episodes, or should have featured these two characters more. But anyway, yeah.
There's an extended sequence in the first episode, toward the end of the first episode, that is just the two of them facing off across a gate with a gate between them. And that to me is the chess match that I think we were talking about loving from Star Trek, The Next Generation. And I feel like there's that in every episode. That was so satisfying and so fun. And the ideas and the way, the fearlessness of her standing up to him. And I just loved the intellectual combat that was on display.
It was so good, but then it was immediately undermined by very stupid people in the scene right after.
Yeah.
Like, well, that's the thing. Like,
yeah, I agree. I agree with you.
You got to keep up. You got to keep up this tête-à-tête. You know, you can't just have two smart people and idiots roaming the same story. I don't know. Like, I felt the same way, by the way, about Sherlock, like the last Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss series. Like, there were some great episodes. I think it premiered really well. These guys do really well when they're swinging and being very ambitious with their stories, and they love to reinvent things we already know. But then I think, like, I saw this with some of their Doctor Who stuff, like, sometimes it just doesn't work. Sometimes you swing and you miss, and that's okay. I appreciate the fact that they swing. I appreciate that Dracula exists. I just wish, some of that second episode felt super rough to me. Like, that was the thing. I haven't gotten to the third episode yet because I felt a little burned by that one.
Yeah.
Dave, did you think the end of the second episode was cool?
Here's the thing about the show that's good and bad. Is it is really unpredictable. Like, the scene you're describing, the first episode, it is very rare for a show to just pause for a good that scene seemed like it went on for like a good 15 minutes, right?
In the best way.
It's a great scene. It's a great scene, but it's just like, it's rare for a show to just pause for 15 minutes to have a confrontation that's just like a dialogue between two characters.
Yes.
And that's great.
That's what I loved about it.
And it leads, and you're always like, that's one of the exhilarating things of watching the show, is like, you just have no idea where it's going next. But the flip side of that is wherever it's going could also be really dumb, which sometimes, like, on occasion does happen, in my opinion. Like, there are some twists that I'm like, okay, that's pretty silly. And I don't want to spoil anything, but, like, suffice to say, I got to the end of the second episode and I was expecting something to happen because you primed me to do so. And I'll just say I thought, okay, that could be interesting, but it could also be really dumb. And I also don't know that the show has done enough to get itself into my good graces that I believe it won't be dumb. And let's just say I'm still on the fence about it because I haven't finished the show yet. But I've gotten so far at this point, I got to finish, Jeff, you know? So I'm going to finish it. So, but I understand the things you liked about it, and I wish there were more of them. That's all I'll say about that. So that's Dracula. It's on Netflix right now. It's what I've been watching this week. Devendra, how about you? What have you been watching?
I've been taking advantage of my Criterion Channel membership. I checked out The Italian Job, the original one starring Michael Caine and directed by Peter Collinson. This movie is not what I expected. Have you guys seen this thing?
No, haven't seen the original.
Yeah.
So I think, like, maybe from the legend of this movie, right? You assume, like, okay, there's a chase with, like, mini cars, right? You assume it's about Michael Caine being suave, maybe something like a bit of a thriller, like the remake was. This movie is straight up, like, goofy at times. It's very weird. Like, this movie is a heist movie, very much so. It has the whole thing of, like, Michael Caine's fresh out of jail. He gets a job. He assembles a team. But it's also, like, tries to be a comedy at times. And, like, there's the soundtrack kind of goes with it, too. So it feels like a weird old-timey comedy of Michael Caine being very silly. And I did not expect that. So I do kind of like, I love revisiting classic movies like this where, like, you may have an idea of what it is. You know, the culture has taught you, oh yeah, the Italian Job. That's a classic, right? And I think there are a lot of great things about this movie. This movie opens with a first person view of somebody driving very, very fast through some very windy, twisty roads, like right on the side of a cliff, maybe the Swiss Alps. It is heart-stopping just watching it because you know somebody's actually doing it, right? So I feel like opening a movie like that, super strong, super engaging. I'm not a fan of, like, the sillier elements of this movie, but I think, you know, they do some good stuff. It is funny watching some of these older movies and just seeing how, like, blatantly sexist they could be at times. It's always a big surprise, I guess, with the 60s and 70s movies. In this one, Michael Caine will walk into a room where somebody hired, like, 10 women to help him celebrate coming out of jail. You know, and he's like, okay, I'll take them all, baby. And, you know, that because that's where we were. And there is one woman, like, basically centered in this movie who is his girlfriend, who loves him despite him treating her like shit all the time. And at the end of the movie, he just kind of gets her out of the main plot, just gets her out of there. So that stuff isn't fun. I think the actual chases and the setup of the suspense is worth watching for. Just seeing, like, the way moving like this used to be made, I think, is really interesting. So if you guys haven't seen it, have you heard, like, about the ending of this movie, like the legendary aspects of it?
No.
Okay. Let me just say this movie invented the term cliffhanger. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
And that, I did not realize that going into this either. Like, the history of that, like, it is sort of like the EGOT thing. This is where that term came from for a very specific reason. And I just found it kind of astounding. Like, I really don't think you could end a modern movie like this in the same way. Like, you couldn't imagine, like, you know, a Mission Impossible movie, or maybe even something lighter, like an Ocean's movie, just ending in the middle of the action, basically, with you not knowing what happens to everybody you've been watching for the 2 hours. So that is kind of fun. I think it's definitely worth watching. It is a fun ride, and the filmmaking is really well done. Except for the comedy. Like, it tries to be funny. There's a guy, one of the, like, computer expert guy, he is really into fat girls. So the entire thing with his character is he's just always trying to molest large women for comedy. That's the comedy of it. So we've come a long way, I think. I like to think we have. The other aspects of it, like, just seeing how formative it is for, like, heist movies, is it's definitely worth watching in that respect.
Cool. That's the original, The Italian Job.
Yes.
And Devendra's, my whole world is shattering. I thought that cliffhanger was coined by the 1993 Rennie Harlan action movie starring Sylvester Stallone. So,
you know, I would like to think it is too.
I'm just joking. I didn't. Just to be clear, I know it's unclear, but I didn't actually think that. Okay. So, Devendra, we all had a chance to watch McMillions this week, right? This is the HBO documentary series about the McDonald's heist. Now, for those who don't know what that is, there was a Monopoly game that McDonald's promoted for many years. While I was in my childhood, I really enjoyed playing this game where you would get, like, a board and you'd match up all these stickers printed on, like, cups and on fries and everything like that. And you could win prizes like a free small fries or a car or $1 million, you know, like all these things. And I spent so long trying to get the piece for Boardwalk, which would give you, like, I think $1 million or something like that. It wasn't until years later when I read a Daily Beast piece about what happened with that that game that I discovered that essentially none of the winners were legitimate. Now, McMillions is a documentary series that covers that story. It was, I think the filmmakers were working on it before the Daily Beast article came out or whatever. It's also being made into a film with Ben Affleck and possibly Matt Damon, I think. So they're separate pieces of work, but this is the documentary version of it. Devendra, what did you think of the first episode of McMillions?
On HBO.
I had a lot of fun with it. Like, this is a documentary that's clearly made in the style of, like, maybe trying to be a documentary version of a Soderbergh movie or of a Coen Brothers movie, of this crazy scheme and them just setting up the pieces. So I feel like the first episode, that's all I've seen. I think critics out there have reviewed up to the first three episodes. I think it's really fun and strong, and it sets up these really interesting characters. Like, there's one FBI agent who I think is kind of an absolute idiot. And he is an idiot who just, like, continuously fail. Like, he just keeps moving forward because, like, people just, like, are humored by his basically inability to focus on any one topic. So, like, he's the guy who hates paperwork. He's the guy who hates doing actual, like, the nitty gritty jobs. He just wants to, like, go out there. He wants to go undercover. He wants to do cool shit.
He seems like the dude that joined the FBI because he saw a movie.
Yes.
And he was like,
this guy saw, you know, Silence of the Lambs. He saw the X-Files. He was like, I want to get in some action. And meanwhile, he is in Jacksonville and nothing is happening. And he gets this one, you know, like, he gets the bite of one story and he kind of goes full on it because it's like, oh, this could be a crazy wild ride. Sure.
Yeah, he's doing it for the entertainment. He's doing his job for the entertainment. Like, I tweeted about the show and somebody responded saying, like, they thought that guy had big Michael Scott energy, which I thought was a
good description. Oh, definitely true.
Definitely. Yeah. But, like,
he talks about being bored at least 8 times in the show.
So he's like Archer or something. Like, he is a character,
a real,
like,
life that. Archer, yeah,
a real life archer, like, just somebody who he wants to just go there and snap some necks with his tactical crude, you know, turtleneck. Like, that's all he wants to do. So I find that guy hilarious, and I really find it funny when, like, actual, you know, those are the people in charge of our security and safety. So I think that aspect of it, of, like, you know, who he is, and then them trying to figure out, like, oh, they figure out somebody is kind of scamming this thing, and they set up the sting operation and the whole undercover thing. I found that really exciting. And it's more like, I really enjoy seeing people deal with this guy. It's like, oh, this guy, he's leading this investigation. We can't get any work done. I find him really, really entertaining. Maybe this thing didn't need to be, like, an hour long for the first episode, because they certainly could have condensed some stuff. But I had a lot of fun with it. I was surprised because I started getting a lot of texts over this week that you guys, it was just no bueno. I don't know what happened.
Jeff, why don't you take a bat to this thing for me?
Yeah. So Devendra is absolutely right that this story of someone ripping off a game that everybody remembers from their childhood because it was ubiquitous. Yes. And it was, you know, it was periodic. Every year there would be the new Monopoly game and you'd see ads and people would, you know, that idea is absolutely fascinating on the face of it and juicy and interesting. And then you have this character, this FBI guy who is larger than life and wacky. Let's basically say
if you're a documentarian, right, and you're looking for a story to tell,
this is gold.
This is gold. This is documentary.
Let's just keep the camera rolling on this guy.
This is the best story you could possibly ask for under the best circumstances you could possibly ask for.
There's almost no way
to mess this one up.
Except they found one. Except they found one. I think this documentary, having only seen one episode, I think it's very bad. Which is a shame because I'm really interested to find out more about how this all went down. But my goodness, is this it just a lesson in how you take amazing material and make it and stretch it and make it completely uninteresting. There's almost zero reason for this to be a visual show at all. This could have been a podcast. This could have been a reading of facts, and it would be more interesting than this.
It could have been court transcript.
Other than like 15 seconds of footage that they show toward the very end of the first episode that ultimately isn't much at all, but is interesting that they got the footage of this undercover moment. There's nothing to the footage, but it's interesting that they have the footage. Other than that, there is no visual thing in this entire show that is additive to the story. It is, yes, it's great to be able to see the people that are talking, but how they're shot is bland and uninteresting. The movie is just rife with reenactment that adds zero understanding or context to what you're viewing. And ultimately, the first episode, which is an hour, has about 3 minutes of useful or compelling information. And let me give you an example. So this is the kind of show where, yes, they're about to set up an undercover moment where they're going to interview a winner of this very large prize that they suspect may have come by it through illegal means. And they're going to set up a fake interview posing as part of McDonald's publicity department to interview this winner and try to find out information. So the way the document, which is a pretty cool thing, the way the documentary presents it is they interview the FBI lead guy. And they're like, and the guy says, when you go into an undercover operation, anything could happen. You got to be prepared for anything. Then they cut to another person, the woman who was there. And she says, I was ready for anything to happen because in an undercover operation like this, anything can happen and you have to be prepared. And then they cut to the FBI guy who actually was there and did it. And he says, yeah, when you go into a situation like this, you have to be prepared because anything can happen. And they spend about 5 minutes setting up what is ultimately nothing, talking about how, in the most banal, trite, obvious way, everybody in the universe knows that you got to be prepared for anything to happen because you're going in and you're pretending to be somebody else. There's no insight. There's no explanation. There's no reason to have any of those quotes in the movie at all. It is padding for what is ultimately a non-event because they just talk to this guy. He tells them some things and then they leave to go find out if it's real or not. It is so devoid of drama in something that should have tons of drama. And then there's a moment where they are presenting him the big check and they painstakingly talk about how we went to the beach. Yeah, and I was worried about going to the beach because when you take someone away from where you thought you were going to go, anything could happen. And then they cut to the guy. He's like, yeah. But I just wanted to see where we could go. And everybody thought I'm crazy for taking him to the beach because anything can happen at the beach. And then they get to the beach. And then, of course, some guy comes up and grabs the check and runs with it. And then they tackle him. And it's like, what even was that? This weird non sequitur that has nothing to do with anything. I guess is interesting in the abstract, but has no bearing on any of the story.
You are re-dramatization of the documentary. You did miss a key point though. Like when our favorite FBI agent, I forget which one I forget which agent he is specifically, but when he's like, they're setting up this whole interview as being this potentially dangerous thing, right? Like, oh man, we got to be careful. Anything can happen, right, guys? Yeah. And this guy's like, let me just throw a fucking bomb into this like well-played scenario. He's like, let's go look at this store, right? And everyone's like, dude, what are you doing? Your one job is to just let's survive this interview and get this guy, you know, dead to rights or something. And he's like, nah, I got to mix it up. Gotta dance over here. I think so much of this, like the fun of the series is seeing this guy, but I agree. They do repeat stuff way too long, but I'm just saying in this one scenario, you missed that key dramatic turn, Jeff. Come on.
I guess, but it ultimately didn't matter for anything. It was not.
But they were right. Something crazy did happen.
Well, and then they show they're like, you know, you might think if you're going to go talk to somebody, you might want to be armed, but you couldn't be armed because if he sees the gun in your ankle holster, he might be onto something. And then so they cut to an insert reenactment of someone taking their gun and putting it under the seat of a car like that happened at all, which it clearly did not. There's no universe in which they took their gun out and put it under the seat before they walked into this dude's house. And yet this documentary is supposed to make me believe that that's because the reenactment shows it, that that's what it's so bad. It's so bad.
Okay. So completely agree, Jeff. And I think that I don't know what went wrong here. It's either filmmakers who fell too in love with their material, they didn't want to cut anything, or something went wrong in the edit. But I would say the edit of this movie or this first episode is disastrous. Like I would say it really, and especially after we had just watched Cheer this week, Jeff, right? Like there feels like
it's such
not
a dramatic juxtaposition between
because that is
two
so
projects.
Well made. You just feel like okay, there's yes, like maybe on occasion you feel like this is a little bit repetitive, but like it really feels like whenever they show you something, it's very intentional that you're seeing it. And this, it feels like I just don't trust the people behind this to make a good use of my time. Honestly, I will say that my occasional podcast co-host Tara Ariano has watched more episodes of the show. And she thinks it gets significantly better and that the wacky FBI agent is less a part of future episodes. So I do want to put that out there. I don't know if I'm going to have the patience to keep going, though. So
well, clearly there are some twists and turns to this tale that are coming.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to them. But, man, like you said, I have no confidence that this show is going to lead me through it. I mean, I kept thinking of things like oh shoot. What's the name of that show with the older guy that killed all those people and then admits to it?
The Jinx.
Get thinking of that show, which also makes extensive use of reenactment, but does it in a way that feels so additive and so.
Yes. I didn't know how bad reenactments could be in terms of, like, here's the thing. The reenactments themselves are not even technically bad. Like they're not. The lighting is fine, you know what I mean? Like the set dressing, the acting is fine. Like the reenactments are not bad from a technical standpoint. It's just, as you said, their inclusion adds virtually nothing to what is happening. So it's almost a fascinating case study in that. In any case, I want to make sure we have some time for our After Dark. But Devendra really enjoyed episode one of McMillions. Jeff and I did not.
Yeah, let me just say, tough crowd over here. Like, guys, I'm just saying, I'm not saying this thing is rewriting the rules of documentaries and changing my life. I'm just saying it's a fun thing to watch. But I think maybe if you're coming off of Glee and you're
cheer,
seeing an amazing
cheer.
If you're coming off of that, you're just like, this show has changed my life. What else can change my life? I mean,
it was an extremely unflattering juxtaposition, right, Jeff?
They're also very, very different things. I think human, like stories about like human triumph and, following a team and things like that, like are very different than something like this. Like it's a very different story. I mean,
disagree. I'm like way more interested in something like McMillions in from a subject matter perspective.
I really wasn't comparing it to Cheer, quite honestly. I was comparing it to Making a Murderer and the Jinx.
Yes.
All these, you know, thematically similar things that use reenactment that, you know, all have been really interesting shows. And man, this one, it just takes something fascinating and beats it into a boring pulp. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, and yeah, I remember you guys loving Making a Murderer and everybody seemed to love that. I couldn't finish that show.
Oh, so, interesting. Interesting.
One of those things. I don't know.
All right, folks. Let's wrap up, and we got a couple After Dark topics to get to real quick, but until next time, so stay tuned to what we'll be discussing next week, but you can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com, email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from adamwarrock.com, our spoiler bumper comes from filmmaker Kyle Hillinger. Until next week, Jeff Cannata, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
You can always find me on Twitter. I'm @Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. And I do a video game podcast called DLC, which you can find at 5by5.tv/DLC. I also do a live play Dungeons & Dragons show called The Dungeon Run. You can find that as an audio podcast, wherever you get audio podcasts, by searching for The Dungeon Run. I think we just hit Spotify, in fact, I think. Also as a video show, it's very high quality. It's done like a TV show. Not just a stream. It really is shot like a television show with television talent. You can find that on YouTube by searching for The Dungeon Run. And we also record live. You can watch the live stream every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Pacific time at caffeine.tv/The Dungeon Run.
How about you, Devendra?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Devendra, and I write about tech at Engadget.com. Be sure to check out the new Engadget podcast, which I'm co-hosting.
And I do a show called Culturally Relevant. You can find that at culturallyrelevantshow.com. The last episode, I interviewed one of the filmmakers behind Little America, the new Apple TV Plus show. Check that out. Zee Chun. Had a great conversation with him. So
nice.
Check it out at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Next week, we'll be talking about Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic the Hedgehog. That's the movie we're going to be discussing.
Gotta go fast. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. That should be fun, I guess. Fun? Question mark? All right, we'll see you later. We watch the movies, play side tracks for the good, side bad. It's the Slash Film Cast. For all the news and the movies coming out, because you know that it's the thing worth talking about. Welcome to the Slash Film Cast After Dark. It's the time of the show where we talk about a variety of random topics we didn't get to during the main show. So
you probably stopped listening already.
Yeah, no one's listening to this garbage. But in any case, there's a few things we wanted to talk about. We got this lovely email from John, listener John, about the Picard show. John writes in about our discussion of Picard, which is on CBS All Access. John says, quote, "I loved part of your discussion because it was extremely frustrating how Picard did Earth in 2399. I needed somewhere to vent about this. I'm very happy with the show. I grew up on The Next Generation. Picard is the captain. He's even like a father to me. However, this is a fully automated post-scarcity luxury communism system. Why would there be gotcha newscasts? Are they trying to get ratings to sell more advertising in a post-money, post-need replicator world? This is a world where people can transport anywhere, where there's anti-grav technology, where there are fully sentient androids, and yet Boston 2399 looks like Boston 2020? Buildings would not look the same. Architecture would not be the same. If you could teleport anywhere, the entire structure of everything would look different. If they had kept it to Chateau Picard, that's fine. That's supposed to be rustic. If they had shown the archive, that would be fine. That had hologram archivists and the teleportation of objects. But everything about Dodge's apartment felt like a 90s sitcom with a few 24th century piece of tech shoved in. I understand it's difficult to imagine what civilian life on Earth would be like in this universe. So they should have not depicted it. Jeff is right. They make this work on Star Trek because they're always in space and we're only ever dealing with Starfleet, not civilian life. So they can always omit stuff that would be hard to design. But like in a world with holodecks, what would your personal apartment actually look like? I would be in a jungle theme room in one room and an ocean veranda in the next. There would be personal massage in another room with someone who is an octopus person. I'm afraid we've been hit with a total lack of imagination by Alex Kurtzman again. Oh, that man. Sincerely, John G.
So, such a good point.
End quote. Yeah. So that email comes from John, and he brings up a great point. A few great points. First of all, I think that the 24th century of Picard looks nothing like the 24th century of the Next Generation. Right? Like it's so much more gritty and like it's more recognizable. And the 24th century of the Next Generation looked boring. You know, the few flashes we see of Earth, it looks like extremely boring and not very interesting. And certainly the last word I would use to describe the depiction of Earth is gritty, right? In the Next Generation.
Yeah.
And I think that this show, Picard, is trying to bring it back to like, hey, this is a future you can kind of recognize. It's not boring because people are killing people all the time in apartments that look futuristic. And
right. It's a little more Blade Runner.
Yeah. You know? And like, why is there Fox News in the future? You know, like when you don't like what would the media economy even be like? Do you need a gotcha newscast to get ads for your show? It's
such a fascinating road to go down that just feels like a complete missed opportunity, a total cop out. And John does a great job of explaining it. You know, if you have a world that is post-capitalism, because there's no such thing as supply and demand anymore, you know, there's infinite supply and that destroys demand. So what do you, you know, he says, he described it as luxury communism or something, whatever that is.
Yeah.
The idea that we are in a post-need world because your needs technology has, you know, eliminated or has provided to an extent that there are no needs anymore. That's a wild thing. There is no useful, advertising is not a thing because there's nobody selling anything because you just replicate it. Like it's such a more interesting intellectual exercise to depict that universe than it is to whatever it is they're depicting on Picard.
Yeah, it reminds me of like this. I've read this Reddit thread once, but like, how would the world be different if you didn't need to sleep, right? If humans didn't need to sleep to
give it to me
to survive, like what?
Right?
How would the world be different? And like the big question was like, would we even have houses, right? Like would people even live in houses?
Because
like the primary function of the house is like keep you protected while you sleep. Wow. And like, what would the world look like? Like, maybe there would just be like kind of communal spaces that people exist in. You know, like it's just so crazy.
An everlasting dorm room. Yeah,
to protect you from the weather is really all that matters at that point. And
yeah. So like, would we have like property in the same way? It's really fascinating. I agree that like, it's a shame that Picard does not explore that and simply opts for like Blade Runner esque future.
Have you guys kept up with that show?
I haven't watched more episodes.
It is, I don't know if we're three or four episodes in at this point. Like, we're finally at the point where a crew is being assembled. It just feels like it took a while. It took forever.
That's something that should have happened at the end of, like, episode one, right? But it's,
One or two. Like, make the pilot, like, a, you know, 90-minute or two-hour, you know, premiere event or something, and then let's get going. This is such a baffling series to me. It's a lot of Patrick Stewart walking briskly to places, and then like a big action scene will happen inexplicably. There are a lot, like there are several scruffy white guys with beards, and I can't tell any of them apart too. Like there's a lot of things happening that are just inexplicable in the show, and I still don't understand the central mystery. It feels like it's basically Blade Runner. But even then, I wish I cared more about what was happening.
Just want Picard visiting a planet, trying to figure out that planet, and going to the next planet. That's all I want. I'm a simple person with simple needs.
Yeah.
So thanks for that email. I don't know. I'll try to get back into it. I think I have to watch more episodes just because I just love seeing Patrick Stewart in that role.
You got to do it.
Yeah, I got to do it. So
I wish, by the way, I do agree with this email. I think of a movie like We Bring Up Her quite a bit. And I think Her is a beautiful movie in terms of how it reimagines a completely different world, even though it's using like the architecture of what we know and like, you know, it's using trains and subways and things we already have. But it's taking the ideas of that and using them in completely new ways. So like you may not even notice watching Her for the first time that, hey, there are no keyboards. There are no mice. There aren't really many things distracting people because we're doing everything with the voice interface. You just talk. It's happening. And the world seems like we don't get a sense of like the world class stratification or anything, but, you know, everything seems pretty chill from what the movie explores, at least. I'd like to imagine like the future of Star Trek would be like that, like a peaceful thing. People get to chill out, play some video games, fall in love with their AIs. And that is the drama of your life. Yeah.
I will say one thing about this email I disagree with, which is John saying like buildings would look different. I agree with you. Buildings would look different. But I do think it's too much of an assumption that just because teleportation technology exists, everyone would use it. Because I find the idea of teleportation technology as depicted in the show to be terrifying. I mean, the idea is that like it deconstructs all of your molecules and reassembles them at the other side. And, you know, like you're basically dying every time you step into a teleport. You know, it's like, why do we still have elevator or why do we still have stairs if we have elevators? And it's like some people like doing it the old fashioned way. You know, I don't
elevators think... break. Escalators break. Okay?
That's right. That's right. And sometimes, by the way, as we've seen many times in Star Trek, teleportation devices malfunction. So anyway, just want to give a shout out to that. Okay, next topic, Devendra, you want to talk about digital movie libraries? This is like we're preparing our After Dark topics now. Uh-huh. Digital movie libraries, something you want to discuss?
Yeah, I just want to know, what do you guys do for your movies? Because I'm finding myself buying a lot more things digitally now. Like Knives Out, just became available over the weekend, and I could have waited for the 4K Blu-ray, but I really wanted to watch it right now. And I want to watch it with my wife, and I want to, to watch it with my parents when I come to Georgia next week. Like, there are things I really want to do immediately. Didn't want to wait for a disc, so I bought it on iTunes. And I'm buying a lot of digital things on iTunes, usually when there are sales. They have some good bundles once in a while, too. But I also appreciate that, most of my iTunes purchases connect to my Movies Anywhere. So if I log into Vudu or something somewhere else where maybe I don't have iTunes access, I can still watch those movies. It seems like we've come a long way. But I have noticed, some studios like Paramount, I believe, do not participate in Movies Anywhere. So a friend of mine bought Knives Out on Vudu and was preparing. They were like, oh, I'll just buy it here because I'm at my work computer or something. And they went back home, couldn't get it on their iPhone, couldn't get it on their Apple TV through iTunes anyway. You could watch it through the Vudu service. But there was just like a bit of confusion there, because those movies don't show up cross-shared on Movies Anywhere. So, yeah, a little thing, but I'm sure it's something a lot of our readers are dealing with. What are you guys doing? And when do you go physical? When do you go digital?
I am actually trying to go physical media all the time now, as much as humanly possible. Yeah. We do have a rule in our household that I have basically three pretty massive bookshelves that are full of Blu-rays. And we do have a kind of soft rule that if one Blu-ray comes in, one must leave the house in some way. And I'll usually like donate it most of the
in
time.
In some way.
Or throw it out, whatever.
Maybe it'll walk out on its own. You don't know.
Yeah.
It has to leave in some way.
And I guess just physical media has become way more important to me because, A, it's still the best way to enjoy many, many movies. Like, there's been several times where I've acquired a movie on, like, iTunes, and I'll watch it, and I will just not be a fan of the transfer, It won't look as good as a Blu-ray. That's something that happens. But also, as we all know, movies can pass in and out of digital streaming services, and it's just nice to have the physical copy. And, of course, physical copies are often the only place you can get the special features these days. So I know iTunes Extras has like a bunch of stuff, but like I recently, Criterion discs are where I'm investing a lot of my money in these days. And so I'm investing in, here's what I'll say. I'm investing more in physical media because I've realized how like ephemeral the digital age can often be. I think it's great for people who are doing digital only. I think it's great, it's probably better for the environment. It's more convenient. I fully support everyone who's going all digital. I think it's awesome. But just for me personally, my choice is like, A, I want to go physical because it just gives me better peace of mind. And B, it's kind of important. It has become inexplicably important to me that like my physical media collection in some way represents my interests. I want it to be kind of like a physical manifestation of like, because
Man, that used to be me 20 years ago.
I had accumulated so many Blu-rays from like, oh, I got this deal. I got this Blu-ray for $4 on Black Friday, 7 years ago. And it's like, I'm never going to watch that Blu-ray again, or even once for the first time. And I've realized like, why am I dragging this place stuff from place to place if it's not even something I like? And so now I realize like, okay, if I'm gonna get the Blu-ray, it needs to be something I really appreciate and that represents kind of the best of my interests in some way. So that's a very long answer to your question, Devendra, but that's kind of where I'm at.
How about you? I used to care about like the idea of someone walking into my home where I live and looking at my shelf and them being able to get a snapshot of who I am by that. And I just don't care about that anymore. I really don't. Mostly because people don't come over anymore. And so, I mean, I'm
you've
probably
become a shut-in, basically, is what you're saying.
I'm a dad, and I therefore have no life. I'm probably going to infuriate a lot of people with my answer to this because I'm just in a post-ownership world. There's so much stuff that I want to watch that I don't have time for that's new. At this point, like, I find myself, it's like books. I rarely mm-hmm. reread a book. Even if I love that book, I rarely reread it because there's always a new book I want to read. There's always more books I want to read. I'm not going to go back to one I already read because there's so many more or other ones I want to read. And at this point, I'm just feeling like that with everything, where mm-hmm. the time is such at a premium that I don't even need to own anything. And the Blu-rays that I do own at this point are in a cabinet, but there's a fancier word for it that we have below our television that does not have any child locks on it. And that's probably on me for not putting them on. But the result is that both of my kids invariably open them up, pop the discs open, see the shiny rainbow colors that are being made by the silicon disc, and like playing with it and spinning it around. And so
you just left your library to die, Jeff.
Every instinct that I held sacred about keeping things nice and pristine has all been shredded by the demolition derby of my children. And the idea of ever having anything nice again, it just seems so foreign at this point. Because my kids, if they get their hands on it, will destroy it. And so even the Blu-rays that I have, I'm like, no, not that one. Oh, okay, whatever.
You may be able to do some disc to digital conversions on Vudu, Jeff. So that may be a way. Grow your digital library from those discs. Yeah.
Well, speaking of digital collections of things, I wanted to talk about something real quick, which is Letterboxd, which I am back on, baby. So,
oh wow,
I created a Letterboxd account when the first service was actually in beta.
Same,
and,
yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is a pretty impressive service from a user interface perspective. And I started adding a bunch of movies, and then I just basically stopped because my rationale was, I already do a lot of work to maintain like my movie watching list on this podcast, the /Filmcast. Like, I already work if the purpose of Letterboxd is to keep track of what I'm watching, mm-hmm. I already have a massive corpus of work that attests to what I've been watching. It's called the /Filmcast, and you can look in our show notes, and it has what we've been watching every week. And so I have no need for that anymore. And recently, I've been getting back into it, and I'm like, you know what? Letterboxd is pretty great. It's pretty great. You can find me at letterboxd.com/Dave Chen. And I realized that this, first of all, like a lot of the people who use Letterboxd, like by definition, you're really into movies. And so movies that I thought, you know, relatively few people have watched that I know, like Memories of Murder, the Bong Joon-ho movie, you know, there's thousands, not only of people who've watched it, but like reviewed it on Letterboxd. And you can read their reviews and see what list they put it in. But really, it feels to me like the good parts of Twitter /film Twitter with very few of the bad parts, you know, because like a lot, when I look through my stream, right, a lot of it just feels like a celebration of great movies. And you could just see like so-and-so left a 4-star review on this, and you can read the review and see the comments. And it feels like an early social network before, you know, the Nazis and mm-hmm. the disinformation campaigns and the hackings and all the you know, all it's basically because the scope of it is so limited to just movies. I don't even think you can easily leave reviews for TV shows on this thing yet, as far as I can tell. It's so limited to just movies. It's like there's very few ways for this service to be distorted in ways that other social networks have been distorted. So I'm having a great time with it. What is your opinion of Letterboxd, guys?
I signed up when it started, same deal, and just never get around to it. Their early apps were not great. It was really hard to like interact with it, and I could not make that time for it. I'm glad to hear it sounds better now, though. I kind of want to put some stuff up there. So maybe I'll revive mine too.
I think it's great just because, yeah, you put something on there and people can like see. And I'll just say one other thing about it. Well, actually, Jeff, let me ask you what your opinion of Letterboxd is. I'm assuming you're too busy to maintain a Letterboxd.
Yeah, I've not touched Letterboxd in literally years. Yeah. But I have heard, I believe, unless I'm misremembering, but I'm pretty sure Peter Cerretta is diligent about his Letterboxd, and I hear him talk about it, and I am envious of that sort of just record keeping aspect of it that he seems to have bought into. And I remember him talking at the end of the year when we were talking about our, you know, top movies of the year, that he just like went back to his Letterboxd and looked through things, and it was all there, and he knew exactly the dates at which he watched stuff. It was like pretty awesome, and I, you know, I envy that, but there's no universe in which I'm going to be able to organize myself to the point where I will do that.
See, that's the thing, is I don't care about the keeping track of things element of it, because I already already do it on this podcast, right? Like, this podcast covers like 80%. We don't talk about everything we watch, but we talk about like, I don't know, 70-80% of it. So it just feels
like... it's a pretty inefficient manner of keeping track, because you have to like look through our feed and then look in the show notes and all, you know, that's not easy.
That's true. But I'm just like, look, I already put enough work into the podcast. I don't need to put any additional work into this Letterbox. That was my thinking before, but, I am more into it for like, the social components, you know, seeing like what people who you follow on Twitter, is like seeing what their opinion is on movies. And I will say that like, the structure of the site makes for some really interesting ways you can juxtapose things. Like many film reviews are one sentence long and are wildly popular on the site. And it's because of the way that just when you're looking at it, it's like you see the movie and it's juxtaposed with a one sentence review. And it's like, it's not as easy to do that on Twitter. Like I'm saying, if someone typed that on Twitter, it would not get the same reaction. Because on Twitter, you need to say, here's my review of Joker or whatever. And so there's like a review on Letterboxd of Joker that was very popular. It was like, you know, a swimming pool is deep to someone who's never been in water. And that was the whole review of Joker. And it was like, very, very popular. And like, if you said, because it's like a review of Joker, I think it's like more popular than if it was on Twitter and you had to say, this is my review of Joker, a swimming pool, you know, like just wouldn't necessarily do as well. I don't know. I think just the format of it leads to some really cool juxtapositions. And for instance, you can make lists on Letterboxd, and I made a list recently. It's called Movies Starring Ewan McGregor, in which all the action abruptly halts so that people on screen can perform an elaborate dance number set to a cover of Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. do you guys know what movies are on that list?
Moulin Rouge?
Moulin Rouge is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Birds of Prey is the other one. That's the one.
Birds of Prey, yeah.
We did that last week. It's a two movie list.
It's a short list.
Basically, I'm saying this is my new format in which I'm going to do my Boom Goes the Dynamite joke.
I like it.
I also made another one. I stole this from Screen Junkies, but sequels to movies starring Will Smith that reference Will Smith's character using an oil painting on a wall. That would be Men in Black International and Independence Day Resurgence.
I'm in love with this, Dave. Yes. I'm in love with this.
Yeah. So anyway, check it out on letterboxd.com/Dave Chen. But I'm really getting back into it. I'm really, really getting back into it. And I'm loving reading everyone's stuff. So
there's a really funny podcast idea here where you come up with, you talk about multiple films that are linked by the most bizarre, obscure
and then manner. Like have people like try to figure out what it is.
you literally talk about these various movies, and then at the end it's how are these movies linked.
Yeah. All right, well, I think we've been going long enough. That's going to bring us to the end of this episode of the Slash Filmcast After Dark. Let us know what you think of the new format, slashfilmcast@gmail.com. we'll see you later.